Of you who'd like to listen to the show again or have missed something, would like to revisit something or comment on something we do, the best way to do that would be to visit our blog, which is addxwordpress.wordpress.com. So that's addax.wordpress.com. One of our occasional collaborators, Rosemary Wally, who's been a presence in Montreal for decades now. She really made her impact a long time ago as an anti-apartheid activist and has since become involved in radio, not specifically with Amandla, in fact, with the show that precedes ours, OWL, Old Women Live. But Rosemary is very faithful to Amandla, and every once in a while she pitches up with an absolutely beautiful piece for us. And I'm very happy to say that tonight that is exactly what we can present to you. It's an interview that, well, actually she introduces it herself. I just wanted to introduce her, so here it is.
Gertrude Hambira is a mother of five children and a grandmother of one. For the past 2 years, she's been living with her family in Winnipeg, where I recently interviewed her. In her home country, Zimbabwe, Gertrude Hambira was the general secretary of the largest trade union, the General Agricultural and Plantation Workers Union of Zimbabwe. Her union's opposition to the disastrous land reform program carried out by the ruling ZANU-PF party, the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party, headed by President Robert Mugabe, put her life in danger, and Gertrude was forced to flee the country in February of 2009. Here's her story.
Zimbabwe is situated in southern Africa. It is a landlocked country, neighbored by South Africa, Zambia, Mozambique, Malawi, and Botswana, and part of Namibia. And we have the mighty Victoria Falls, the Kariba Dam, and it used to be an agro-based economy. Once upon a time, Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa, but that breadbasket of Africa is no more.
Why?
There have been some economic and political factors. If you are in a conflict situation and you allow the land to fail you, then that is the end of everything. Zimbabwe has been reduced to destitute. We used to survive, we used to feed our neighbors, but nowadays, no, we are having to beg from our neighboring countries because of the so-called land reform program, which was initiated in 2000 by the ZANU-PF regime. Before independence, we were colonized by the British. We got our independence after a long struggle of independence, which was bloodshed, and I would say it was really bad, and we wouldn't want to repeat that. After independence, it was lovely. We enjoyed our freedom for the first time. We could really feel it in the air that this is freedom. This is freedom. And we really had good hopes when our President Mugabe extended a reconciliation hand to the whites who had actually colonized us before and said we need to coexist and build this country together. Yes, we did journey together for a while up until early 90s when our labor movement, where I belonged, started to realize that things were going haywire within the government structures. That was the beginning of another second struggle.
What happened?
There was bad governance in terms of resources for developing the country, which were brought into the country by organizations such as IMF, the World Bank, and all those. Those resources were not channeled to develop the communities. Some of them were actually channeled into individuals. And then there was also the issue of the war vets situation, where they demanded payment for their participation in the liberation struggle when the money was no longer there. And then there was also the issue of payment of farms. We had an agreement of compensating the farms, getting the farms from the white commercial farmers and the government recycling the people. And the British government was actually compensating for that. And that compensation actually was misused as well. And now came the chaotic land reform program, whereby The white commercial farmers were actually forcibly moved from the farms they had occupied for so many years. I would say that, yes, there was some imbalances between the black and white in terms of land allocation, and that imbalance had to be actually corrected. The way it was done did not go on well with the entire citizens of Zimbabwe, because it only benefited the political elite.
The land was supposed to be divided up and shared more equally with the local population, and this took too long, didn't it?
Yes, it did take long, and the government did not address it at the right time. Yet we had organizations, the labor movement, civic society, calling for an equitable land distribution, and also my organization also was calling for land to the landless, because my organization is made of people who migrated from neighboring countries, and they migrated during the colonial era, and they had not known of any other home apart from that farm. Farm workers were actually governed by what was known as the Master and Servant Act, which gave them the right to fire and hire at the same time. So because your entire livelihood was actually attached to the farm, the employer, the white commercial farmers, would say, if you join the union, you go with the union. I don't want to see you here. Or if you stay here, I'll take care of you. And thus increasing the rate of cheap labor, bondage, and exploitation, until after we got our independence, that legislation was abolished. And then we had the Reconciliation Act, which embraced all the labor issues and other areas. And that Reconciliation Act also was repealed after some time, and where the Labor Relations Act gave more powers to trade unions to go and organize in the farms. But it was so difficult, very difficult, because farm workers have been so attached to their employer. All their working life they have been told, this is your home, I will take care of you, you don't have to go anywhere. Getting them into the trade union was so tough. We had to do it through persuasion. We had to do it through educational programs. We had to find so many strategies. If we don't win them today, we'll just leave them and let them digest what it means to have freedom, to enjoy your rights. So it took so many years for the farm workers to be unionized.
These farm workers would have depended totally on the white employers for everything.
That's correct. Everything, everything. If you look at all the basic necessities, they were all at the farm. There was a clinic, there was a school, not a very good school though, and the teachers from those schools were not trained at all. These were teachers drawn from the field. If you would know a little bit of ABCD, you would then be promoted to a teaching position. The children will go probably from grade 1 up to 2 or 3, and then into the field, cheap labor. I remember very well when I was growing up, we used to think that we were helping the mothers, our parents in the field, yet it was a source of cheap labor, child labor, and it's still even rife today in the agriculture sector because of the current situation. I grew up in the farming community in Marondera, which is towards east as we head towards Mozambique, 30-40 kilometers from Harare. My parents used to work at a farm, and we used to say, we didn't know that this was child labor, because the system was, our parents were given large tasks in the field, and for you to be paid for that task, you have to finish it by the end of the day. An individual who didn't finish that task, he or she would have to bring his family to assist. So school was not a necessity, was not a priority, but to help the parents in the field so that at the end of the day they are paid, and then we can have bread on the table, we can have our staple food starter, and we can also probably have a little bit of clothing. Not school, that was not a priority, but the priority was to get bread and butter on the table. So as I grew up looking at these things, I really felt that this was really unfair for us. We cannot go to school. We are all confined in this vicious circle where you don't know what is happening in the outside world. So as I grew up, my parents tried to give me a little bit of education, and which I did up to my grade 11, 12. And thereafter, I went back to the farms to say, oh, this is no good. Someone needs to expose this thing. Someone needs to speak out for the voiceless. And that's how I started up the struggle for the farm workers.
Then you got into the union movement?
Yes, I worked for the clothing industry as a shop steward and also decided that agriculture is the best place for me to be. From a child laborer, I rose to a shop steward, to a union organizer, to an educator, to child labor coordinator, to a gender coordinator, and finally, I got the position of a general secretary in 2000 when the road was rough in the agriculture sector.
Can you tell us about the road?
This is the chaotic road of the land reform grab. I would say, in fact, it was a do-or-die situation where the supporters of Mugabe regime will go at a farm, order a farmer to leave the farm there and there. They would say, we are giving you 3 hours, 2 hours, 1 hour to pack your particulars. And within an hour, you would only grab your family and leave the entire property, the entire what we have worked for so many years, and go nowhere. But what people didn't know from across the world was, yes, the farmer might leave the farm. And in Zimbabwe, farms are so big. Each employer, each farmer used to employ 50 to 200 people, 300, even 1,000. Farm work is labor intensive. And behind that one farmer, there are 200 people who are also being displaced. While the farmer was trying to make his getaway, even out of the country, to go to Australia, United Kingdom, Canada, America, there's no way he was going to take these 200 farm workers with him. They became displaced and destitute.
There was an awful lot of violence as well, wasn't there?
There was a lot of awful violence, gross human rights violations. As a trade union worker, as a trade unions are not there to negotiate wages only, working conditions. They look at the entire welfare of the worker. When these workers were being displaced, thrown out of land, the trade union started to document all the gross human rights violations. They started to stretch their arm to start feeding these workers, to work with other NGOs to say, this situation in which we are is not of our own making. We don't have food. Children have been pushed out of school, let alone HIV/AIDS is not sparing us. The civic society, other NGOs started to chip in to help, but that help did not go a long route because they were stopped. Food, which was meant for farm workers, clothing, was confiscated as we went to deliver that food. So it was really a tough, tough situation. People were killed, both farmers, farm workers, animals, you name it. It was really, really gross. If there's anyone who wants to see the documentary which I produced, we took it upon ourselves as a union to say, I think the world needs to know these things, that this is not an issue of black and white. It is an issue of human rights violations.
So you made a film?
We used the mobile phones to do our shootings because there was no media allowed into the farms, let alone independent media. We developed techniques to get information from the people. For you to be part of your union, you have to go to the community and be part of them. When these things were happening, we were actually in the field.
When the farmers are removed from the farms, these are the white farmers that have owned these farms sometimes for generations, who was taking over the farms?
A group of youth will be assigned to go and invade the farm. That doesn't mean that that farm will belong to that group of people. They are doing it on behalf of a high-ranking government official, a minister, army commander, the president himself, and all other political elites. Not a homeless person, not a landless person, including them. Once they've grabbed that farm, a certain minister will say, "This belongs to me. Can you go to the next one?" So you'll find that not only do they own single farms, but they own multiple farms.
Are they capable of actually farming?
Farming is not something you would say that this is my farm now and by tomorrow the field is green. It's a process. And that process cannot even take a year or two or three. It's a very long process. Had they wanted to be part of this process, they would have started small and then grow big and learn from the white commercial farmers from the farmers, farm workers, they had enough experience which they had developed over the years. Experience, expertise, knowledge. Despite that, farm workers did not go to school. They knew what was crop rotation. They knew what type of fertilizer to apply on this crop. But that was all gone within a couple of days. It's so easy to destroy.
A lot of people have been displaced. What's happened to them now?
Some are still abandoned in those farms. Some of them migrated into the urban area and they just came into the city and built shacks, which were later destroyed. I can't remember the exact year, what was known as the Operation Cleanup. We used to call it our tsunami, where the government went by and just destroyed those houses, and they had nowhere to go. And also some of the farm workers, they went to neighboring villages to try and buy a piece of land so that they can stay there. But others, they were just abandoned, they become displaced, and up to now they are still suffering, because even those who have taken over those farms, they are not utilizing them. They are saying that you have to work for us. You made the white person rich, and now the turn is for the black person to be rich. You have to work for us.
What's been the reaction of Zimbabwe's neighbors?
We have turned to our neighbors, South Africa, everyone, the SADC community, but they failed to address the situation of Zimbabwe. Agriculture was the backbone of Zimbabwe. When that backbone was broken, all the industry did not function. Factories closed, and people went to South Africa, Botswana, Malawi, Zambia. And also, it's not rosy in South Africa. It's not rosy. And as the leadership in the neighboring country see that happening, they never pointed a finger at him. They just looked. Because for them, it was a hero of Africa. He was taking land and giving it to the black. But which blacks? That's the question which remains unanswered up to now. Who benefited from the land reform program?
And what's been the reaction of Canada?
In terms of developmental programs going direct to the community, they have really done a lot, but more could have been done. I remember very well my organization. We put up a school at one of the villages because we had children walking for about 20 kilometers a day to go to the nearest school, and the girl child was actually not finishing school. Along the way, she was abused, and we got funding from the Canadian government through SIDA, and we put up a block of school. We now had these new settlers in that particular area saying this school belongs to us, and then we had to say no ways, this school belongs to the community. Every child has the right to go to school. And I'm glad to say that that school, regardless of the challenges, at least the children are no longer walking long distances. We had a program through the International Labour Organization called Stop Child Labour. School is the best place to work. That program, irregardless of the current challenges, is moving on slowly. We have a coalition called CACLAS, Coalition Against Child Labour. This is a coalition made of the trade union, the teachers, and some non-governmental organization. As a trade union, we identify the children who are working in the field, those children, the vulnerable, I would say the vulnerable of the vulnerable, those affected by HIV as orphans, and we withdraw them from the field and try to put them into schools, because we are saying that where there's a child, there's a teacher. And in the farms have been forgotten. And we are saying, teachers, we need to work together. You cannot only work in the urban areas or in the villages which are structured, but we really need to go right in the remote areas, in the farms, and work with these children. So that's why we formed this coalition.
What's Canada doing in terms of the very well-documented human rights violations in Zimbabwe?
I will give a very good example of myself. Canada, Amnesty International, was the first one to write to the Zimbabwean government to say stop the violation of Gertrude Hambira and her constituency. And then later started flying from all over the world to to stop my persecution. And even up to now, as we are talking right now, persecution of human rights defenders continue. Recently, we had Beatrice Mutetwa, and prior to that, even prior to my persecution, we had Justina Mukoko, a very prominent human rights defender who was kidnapped and kept in secrecy for 21 days. Canada stood up and said, "We want Justina out right now." Then came myself, Canada stood up. Then came today, as we are talking right now, Beatrice Mutetwa, a prominent lawyer who represents human rights defenders in the country. She was also arrested, and Canada was up in arms.
What happened to you that Canada had to come to your defense?
When I was interrogated by JOC, the Joint Operations Command, I was not arrested, but I was called for interrogation by the high-ranking officials of the Army, the Police, the Air Force, the Central Intelligence, and I was highly interrogated and told that I need to be thrown into prison and be tortured to death. But what I did when I went for that interrogation, I took a human rights lawyer with me, my work colleagues, and that is what saved me. Because as we walked into the interrogation room, they said, "Look at her, she comes here with other people." Meaning that had I gone there on my own, we wouldn't be talking today. Knowing from past experience, those who have been called before that committee, that will be the end of their life. So after that interrogation, there was nowhere they were going to say, "Gertrude, you stay, the rest you can go." Because already these guys, my colleagues, had already seen who was part of this structure which was interrogating me. So after about 3 hours, they let us go and they said, "We are not done with you. You need to hang around. We will call you again." So they let us go. 5 days later, they pounced on our office. I'm a woman of faith, because even when we go out into the field, we used to pray for God to be with us, to guide us, to protect us. We really pray. We fast and pray. On this particular day, when these other guys came to the office, my angel just told me, "Gertrude, leave the office. Go and pick up your son from school." And I said, "No, I can't leave the office. I still have other things to do." And I was told, "Just leave this office." And I left the office. So when I left the office, my colleague said, "Please, can you bring us some rolls and bread? We need to drink tea when you come back." I said, "No problem." I went to the convenience store to buy bread. And then as I was walking to the office, my instinct, my angel tells me, "Don't go to the office." I said, "Why? I have bread here. We need to make tea." And then my instinct says, "Go and pick your son from school." And then I said, "I still have an hour." Then I said, "Okay, I'll go to school." I then went to school to pick my son. In Zimbabwe, things are so bad. When we are driving, you take your purse because you can be burglared and put it in the trunk. So that is where I put my purse and my mobile phone. And I drove to school to pick my son. And I parked my car. I waited for 30 minutes and then went to pick my son from the classroom. And I drove back. As I was approaching home to drop my son, my conscience tells me, "Pull off the road." I pull off the road, and then my son said, "Why are you stopping?" I said, "Well, I need to check on my phone." I take my phone, I look at my phone. There are more than 50 calls, all of them from the office. And then I said, "Oh, these guys, they are crazy. They want bread from me." And then I said, "Okay, let me try and call them back." So as I call them back, no one is speaking. Some of them have actually switched off their phones. And then eventually someone calls me and said, "Gertrude, where are you? The office is under siege. Just leave the country right away." And then I said, "So help me God." I then started trembling, shivering, to say, "Now where do I go? I'm here with my son, with my handbag, my purse. That is all I have." I had to gain my strength. I had to pray. I gained my strength. I called one office to say, "This is the situation." And then the civic society was alerted. The world was alerted. And ZCTU was alerted. And they said, "Okay, wherever you are, just stop there. We are coming to get you." And then they came and picked me up. And then the first thing they asked me was, "Do you have your passport with you?" Fortunately, I had spent 3 days looking for my passport in the house. And that very same morning, I said, "Oh, I need my passport. I might be traveling anytime soon." And I'd put it in my purse. And then they said, "Okay, we'll take your son, we'll take care of him, and we are now working on a route for you to leave the country. because we don't want another bad situation. You just have to leave the country. And there I was, leaving the country unceremoniously. I went to South Africa. South Africa is not a bed of roses for immigrants. It's so tough. I was emotionally distressed for 10 months. Despite that, I continued with my advocacy. I traveled to Europe, to the International Labour Organization, to many different organizations to say, this is the situation. I had a United States visa, and my daughter was already here. She came here to do a master's degree in food science under the scholarship of Rotary International. She said, Mom, you just have to leave South Africa. I can't stay there. I said, I can't. What about my children? Eventually, she said, we will work out something. We have lots of people here who are going to help you to get out of South Africa. But at the same time, while they were working here, that's the Rotary, I went to the United Nations in South Africa to say, this is my situation, I'm under surveillance. And the UN says, we know about your situation, but you just have to go through the processes. There are lots of refugees here. And going through that process meant I was going to be in South Africa for more than 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So eventually, the guys here from the Rotary International engaged David Mitas, a human rights lawyer here, and other lawyers. They put their wisdom together and they said, if she has a United States visa, let her go to the United States. And then she can cross through the Niagara and declare refugee. And that's what I did. But at the back of my mind, I said, oh Lord, what about these 3 children? There was a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 15-year-old.
So how did you get your children here?
I had to get them back from South Africa to Zimbabwe. They were being under the custodian of my church friends and the church. As we were working on my refugee claim here, a petition was put down to go to the immigration minister to say we need to get these children out of Zimbabwe like yesterday. And yeah, it worked on very well. After a year, a project was put by the Rotary Club, which was called Out of Africa. You can Google it, Out of Africa Rotary International. And they got the children out of Africa. The children who had never traveled abroad, one of the Rotarians volunteered to go and meet them in South Africa and bring them here. So I'm really grateful.
So how long have you been here now, Gertrude?
2 years, 2.5 years now.
And you're continuing with your work?
I continue with my work. Only 2 days ago, I was addressing a May Day gathering, and then we had a very wonderful march despite the cold. Right now, I'm here in Canada, and my children have all good opportunities, but I still have a guilty conscience to say, what about those children I left back? So I would want to say that we will keep on telling the story. We need to support each other. Those who are prayerful can do that. Those who are strong advocates can do that. There are so many strategies which are non-violent so that we can strive for a peaceful world, let alone Africa.
Now, if you would like to see the video that Gertrude Hambira made in the rural areas, it's called House of Justice, and you can find it on Google. This is Rosemary Wally with Laura Yaris in Montreal.
Blah, 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 blah.